นะโมตัสสะภะคะวะโตอะระหะโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะนะโมตัสสะภะคะวะโตอะระหะโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะนะโมตัสสะภะคะวะโตอะระหะโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะอิทัปปิกะวิปิกะอรัญญะกะโตวะรุกขะโมละกะโตวะสัญญะกะระกะโตวะ So I wanted to talk a little bit this evening about Ajahn Mahabua. And many of you, or some of you may know that Ajahn Mahabua is one of the great leaders of the Thai forest tradition, and just passed away last Sunday, aged 98, regarded by many people in Thailand as an arahant, and certainly one of the defining figures in Buddhism in the last half a century in that area. So I just thought that by way of a homage to Lung Tha, as he likes to call himself, and let's talk a little bit about him this evening. Of course, I wasn't a direct student of his by any means, and I only met Ajahn Mahabua a couple of times very briefly. But certainly a very extraordinary and charismatic person whose life has impacted so many that it's very difficult, if you haven't actually seen these things for yourself, to understand what they're kind of the power of the impact. And I was at Ajahn Mahabua's monastery in about 1995 or 6, and that was before he started to get very famous. But still, there was, I don't know how many, maybe 2,000 people or something coming to bring dana. And at that time, he would have been well over 80. But he would still come out from the monastery and just go out just to the front part of the monastery, and then all the people would wait there, and they'd go for, they'd take the alms. So he's still keeping the Pindapata practice at that time. And the star Ajahn Mahabua was known for his very quite aggressive and energetic style, both of practice and of teaching, which you can see in all kinds of things, and it's affected the forest tradition in many ways. When they go for alms around there, it's a precision event. The monks sort of walk really fast, and all the donors are there with their little plate with the little lumps of sticky rice, and you have to get it all kind of ready in advance, because it's like target. It's like a moving target. It's like at the show or something like that. You've got to get the ball in the mouth of the clown or something. It's like that. They're going past with the ball. Ding, 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 ding. And it's very much Raj Mahabhu's personal style. It's like bringing that energy is really one of his dominant characteristics. And he's kind of infused that into his students and so on. One monastery I was at, Ajahn Dan's, when they'd go for alms round. Luckily, when we were visited there, I had done my knee and I was on crutches. But the rest of the monks, when they went for Pindapat, they would literally sprint back from alms round. And some of the monks we were visiting would briskly walking back arms, and then the resident monks saying, "Come on, come on, come on, come on." And so to get back there. And so this Ajahn Mahabua's character, his style, and it's one of the things that I love about the forest tradition is that they're so kind of happy to be themselves, He's not kind of putting on this persona that, a good monk has to be like XYZ, I'm supposed to be peaceful and use refined language and all of these. He's very crude in the way that he speaks often. He uses a very kind of coarse, colloquial village language. Sometimes you look at it and you go, "Phew." He was quoted on the front page of the Thai newspaper. There were some monks who were protesting about something or other in Thailand, and the monks and Ajahn Mahabua was quoted saying, "These monks are mangy dogs." Can't say that. And you've got to understand, in Thai, that's like 10 times as bad as it is in English. It's a really bad, it's really offensive. So, he's got this kind of this character. Of course, he used to be a kickboxer before he was a monk, right? So we were just earlier discussing my career before I was a bhikkhu, and no doubt that that has some influence on my character. But Ajahn Mahbubh's kickboxing attitude was definitely a strong part of how he taught the Dhamma. And so you get these, you know, quite kind of macho kind of approach, you know, you've got to jump in the ring and kick the defilements down and bash him in the head and don't give up, you know, you just got to keep on going and got to keep on hitting, don't let them until they're not going to get up again. So it's all kind of horses for courses, you know. I mean, it's very funny. Like, I, you know, many of you have been to some of my talks, and I don't talk like that at all, right? I never teach like that. However, I did once, right? I think once in the last 7 years I've been in Sydney, I was giving a meditation interview, and this woman was on this meditation retreat, the Metta retreat. For some reason, I said, well, you know, sometimes you just got to get into the ring and hit the defilements down and knock them down. And this woman just looks at me and goes, how do you know? I'm a boxer. Well, she thought that I was. I don't know why. Anyway, that's not something you expect when you're teaching someone in a meditation retreat. Anyway, that's beside the point. So Ajahn Mahbubh kind of brings this very kind of spirited, very fiery approach to his practice. Like many, he died at the age of 98. So he was a direct student of Ajahn Mahbubh. Of Ajahn Mun. And many of you would know that Ajahn Mun is more or less the founder of the modern forest tradition in Thailand, especially the northeast forest tradition. And just by way of a little bit of background, when the forest tradition emerges from the reforms that were brought in Thailand in the mid 19th century, starting in the mid 19th century, by the Crown Prince, who became known as King Mongkut. And while he was a bhikkhu, he instituted a number of reforms in the Thai Sangha, which were all orientated towards trying to bring the Sangha back to a more authentic understanding of Buddhism. And trying to overcome the kind of the superstitions and rituals and so on, which had become very dominant. And King Mongkut's reforms were more or less orientated towards a kind of urban and scholarly approach to Dhamma. And he wasn't a meditator as such. And so, but it was sort of the next generation was Ajahn Mun, and he sort of more or less continued that same program, but brought it into the sphere of meditation. So, using the taking an approach to meditation which was founded on the authentic Buddhist meditation texts, so founding on things like Anapanasati, breath meditation, and things like the recollection of the Buddha, Buddhahang Sati. Some of the very popular meditations in Thailand that recollect the word buddho. Buddho is a meditation word. Investigation of the parts of the body, investigation of impermanence, all of these kinds of things, which are the meditations actually taught in the Pali canon, as opposed to what was often practiced, which would be more kind of like a kind of magical approach to meditation, you know, using various mantras and sacred diagrams and invocations and rituals to develop perhaps various psychic powers or to do various kinds of magic or black magic and these kinds of things. So these kinds of practices were and still are very popular in Thailand. And so Ajahn Mun's innovation was to really bring that emphasis back onto the authentic core meditation teachings. And of course he practiced with such dedication and such sincerity that he was widely regarded as an arahant, as a fully enlightened one. Now, when Ajahn Mahbubh was a young monk, even though he was from the northeast of Thailand, he ordained and was studied for 3 years in Bangkok. That's why they call him Maha. So the word Maha just means great, but when it's used as a title for Thai monks, it means one who's completed the 3 basic years of the study. They have the Thai study curriculum. They have a total of 9 years, which is more or less a PhD equivalent, and the 3 years are more or less a bachelor's equivalent. So Maha means you've completed that. So he, Ajahn Mahabua, lived in Thailand, just in Bangkok, just after he was ordained, and studying there and doing his meditation when he had spare time. And in some of the, when he's talking about that period later, he'll say that actually, you know, not only was he the only meditative monk in the monastery, but that the other monks would actually make fun of him when he tried to meditate. Yeah, what are you doing, Bua? You know, you're going to go off to heaven, are you? Tell us what it's like. Tell us what it's like when you find Nirvana, will you? So they're openly ridiculing him in public for trying to meditate. Yeah. Because everybody knows this is just legends. This is things that happened in the Buddhist day. It's got nothing to do with actually what we're practicing here. That's how a lot of the monks would think. And so he just ignored them and got on with his practice. And he heard these rumours of Ajahn Mun, and he heard people talk about this monk. And when they talked about it, they always used this word arahant when they were talking about him. And he became fascinated. And he determined that as soon as he finished his studies, he would find this monk and go and live with him and study and practice with him. And of course, that's what he did. So at that time, Ajahn Mun had a circle of students who were living with him and practicing with him. Ajahn Mun himself was from northeast Thailand. He's from Uwan Ratchathani, but he spent many years practicing in the north of Thailand before he came down to back to the northeast to build his monastery where he lived for the rest of his life. So they had a very kind of very small circle, but a very dedicated practitioners in those days, many of whom went on to become great monks in their own right, and many great teachers from that generation. It's quite an extraordinary kind of outpouring that you saw in Ajahn Mun's generation that, you know, really hasn't been repeated, even though all of those monks then went off and started their own monasteries and their own lineages and things. But you don't see that same constellation of you know, outstanding meditators around a single teacher like you had in those days. And so there's a whole generation. You know, we've only heard of a few. You know, in the English translation, we've heard of Ajahn Chah, we've heard maybe Ajahn Tate, maybe Ajahn Lee, and one or two others. But actually, there's a lot of other great teachers, Mpu Chong, Mpu Khao, Mpu Wan, Mpu Phan, and whose, you know, teachings have not been translated into English, and so they remain very little known. But in the forest tradition itself, the forest tradition is almost entirely based on the teachings of these particular teachers, right? Very little reference to the suttas or anything like that. It's just on the teachings, and most of those teachings, apart from the Dhamma talks and so on, but they come from the autobiographies, the life stories of these different Ajahns. And the first one of those life stories was written by Ajahn Mahabua himself, and he wrote the life story of Ajahn Mun. And if any of you have read the biography of Ajahn Mun, you know that it's a quite astonishing work with lots of amazing stories, of psychic power stories, and devas, like the tourist devas from Germany who come to listen to the Dhamma teachings, and the different kind of events, like the time when he was meditating in the forest, and then there was another monk meditating in the village, and he read the other monk's mind, and he saw that he wasn't able to stay with his meditation, and he kept on thinking about his wife, so he went down to this monk and said to him, "Stop thinking about your wife, you're going to end up disrobing." And the other monk was so terrified to find out Ajahn Mun had been reading his mind, he just dropped everything and ran off straight away. After that, Ajahn Mun realised that he had to be a bit more circumspect with how he approached these things. So Ajahn Mahabua's biography of Ajahn Mun is one of the great documents of the forest tradition, and then kind of inspired many other biographies, of which only a couple have been translated into English, but there's many more in Thai. So Ajahn Mahabua's personal approach to practice was very dedicated. He followed the ascetic practices, Dutanga practices very rigorously, and he was kind of intimidatingly kind of dedicated in his own approach to meditation. His own practice was very strict. For example, he would keep a practice for a long time where he would only accept food that was placed in his bowl on alms round. So normally what they do in the northeast of Thailand is you take your bowl and you go for alms through the village, and people will usually only put sticky rice in the bowl at that time, and then when you get back to the monastery, people will often come and then cook some food and so on, and then offer the rest of the meal is actually offered in the monastery. That's the custom in the northeast of Thailand. In other areas of Thailand, they'll give the whole meal when you're on the alms round, but not in the northeast typically. So actually to do that practice in northeast of Thailand is actually a very strict practice, because it means that many days you'd just be eating sticky rice. Sometimes you might get a banana, sometimes you might get bits and pieces of other things, but not very much. Anyway, so Ajahn Mahabhubha would do this practice and always keep it very strictly, but he said that Ajahn Mun would always would kind of see him, and Ajahn Mun would kind of talk to him and say, "Oh, Bua, by the way, did you remember that thing I was talking about?" And he'd kind of, while he was talking to him, he'd slip some other food into his bowl after he kind of distracted him. And yet only Ajahn Mun could do that. Nobody else could get away with it. But somehow he managed to get it in there too quickly before he could stop it. So he always had this kind of tendency to be very ascetic. And one time he said that in his practice he was just sitting, he attained a very, very deep samadhi in his practice, and he would just be sitting all day, one pointed all day and all night, for many, many hours, and did that for a long time. And then eventually Ajahn Mun said to him, "Come, Bua, what are you doing? You're just sitting there like a tree stump all day. When are you going to get any wisdom like that? You're just sitting like a frog." So he said, okay, so he said, go and do some investigation, investigate your body, investigate impermanence, not self. So he said, okay, so that's what he went, and he just threw himself into investigating the five khandhas and impermanence and suffering and sitting through pain for many hours. So he's just kind of sitting there and enduring the pain and just watching it until the pain breaks and so on. And he kept on doing that practice again, for a long time. Until Ajahn Mun eventually said, "Oh, what are you doing? You're going to kill yourself. go and sit and make your mind peaceful. Sit in samadhi for a while." So he had this tendency to go into extremes, and he always, like when I was in Thailand in the mid 90s, Ajahn Mahabhubha always had this kind of reputation for being kind of a tough guy, for being very quite aggressive, and some people would say, "Oh, I couldn't go and see him. I'd be too scared to go and ask him any questions or anything." But that was only one side of him. It's very much a persona, and it's one of the things that even though I had not very much contact with Ajahn Mahabhubha and his generation of monks, but it's one of the things that I saw was just the emptiness that they bring to these things. While it was something that they just completely drop, And Ajahn Brahm said that when he went to stay with Ajahn Mahabhubha, and he'd heard this kind of, he had this reputation, and when it came time for the evening afternoon chores, he was sweep. They were all the monks who'd come out and they'd sweep the monastery, and Ajahn Brahm was sweeping the wrong way. He was supposed to sweep it into the central place or whatever, and he was sweeping the leaves in the wrong direction. And Ajahn Mahabhubha came up, and Ajahn Brahm said he was just so kind and just so gentle in the way he sort of pointed out that, "No, it's not the right way, you should be sweeping them in here." And he did it very, very gently. And so he had this very soft side to him, and certainly a very good sense of humour. He was always kind of laughing and so on. Again, this is a big difference between the Thai arahants and the Burmese arahants. In Burma, the monks, they have this kind of thing where you're really not supposed to have any emotions. It's quite intimidating. There's nothing really there. Whereas the Thai, especially the forest monks, they're always kind of laughing and cracking jokes and so on. Much more lively. Because of this kind of tough guy reputation, Arjuna Mahabhu was really, in those days, was really the monk's monk. Yeah, he was where you'd go. That was a kind of the hardcore monastery. You know, you'd go to really if you wanted to learn how to sit through pain or something like that. And it was like that for many years. Yeah. Now, when I only met Arjuna Mahabhu twice, only for brief periods. One of those, as I mentioned, was about 1995 or 96. And what happened was that my friend Ajahn Chandiko had organized a trip around northeast Thailand to visit various of the Ajahns and to take some of the young monks, including myself, who hadn't met them, to go and visit some of these places and see what they were like. So we went around and visited various people and so on, and we arrived at Ajahn Mahabhu's monastery shortly before the morning dana, and my goodness, it's an amazing kind of scene. So you have to know is that his monastery is still just a very, very basic forest monastery. Yeah? Dirt paths cleared through the forest, a very simple, fairly small sala. The bowl washing area is, you know, just you know, buckets of water with rings on logs that you wash your bowl with. Very, very simple. And you know, quite different, completely different to the Thai city monasteries that you see, which is, you know, all kind of very, very fancy, and all the kind of the gild and the little glass and cut glass and these kinds of things. Nothing vaguely like that at all. Even a lot of the forest monasteries that you see today are very, very developed. They have big kind of salas and, you know, often quite luxurious kutis and things like that. Ajahn Mahabhu still kept everything very the same. Didn't have any electricity in the monastery. Very, very basic. And he had this old sala, which was actually the original sala, original hall that was built when they built the monastery. And of course, it's completely inadequate for the thousands of people that were going through there, but Ajahn Mahabhu refused to do anything about it, right? And refused to build a new sala. But shortly before we visited, what happened was that he was away, Ajahn Mahabhu was away teaching in Bangkok, and Ajahn Mahabhu's second monk, his vice abbot for 20 or 30 years, was an English monk. So again, this is something which I think is not so well known in the West, is that actually, you know, it was actually an English monk who was the second. You know, the second abbot at the most, you know, well, the biggest forest monastery, or the, you know, the most well-known forest monastery in all of Thailand, and he himself, Lompu Paniwada, had a very good reputation as a very highly respected monk. He died a few years ago. So, anyway, while Ajahn Mahabhu was away teaching, then Lompu Paniwada got the builders in, and they actually cut the sala was on wooden stilts, so they actually cut the stilts off and jacked it all up and built a new concrete sala underneath and put the old wooden one on top. Yeah? And while Lungta was away. And so, of course, he sort of got back and everything had been... He had to kind of organise with military precision. So by the time he got back, he just kind of grunted. But even though it was like still very, very simple, like literally, not, they didn't even paint the concrete. Yeah, it was literally just bare concrete, yeah? Again, it's just completely different from not only city monasteries, but even the forest monasteries in Thailand. So this is this simplicity that he brought to things, which is, you know, quite... I have this incredible respect for that, because it's just so easy, especially when you get to that level of you know, popularity and fame and so on, to you know, to start to justify things. You know, well, we have to build a big sala because there's lots of people coming. And then it turns into a whole big thing, you know, and you find that everybody's spending their time building big things rather than actually doing the practice that they were there to do in the first place. You know? And he just really kept that. It was quite astonishing. So, anyway, so we went there, we got there shortly before the meal time. You know, there's like, I don't know, 80 monks or something, and so the main sala, or the resident monks stay in. And because there's not enough room for everybody, then they put visitors and other things around. So we were like in white. We were just in the bush, basically. And there's a little cleared area, and we just sat on some mats there, because there's literally no room in the main sala. And so, you know, and there's various things happening around like that. and all the food that's brought back from alms and the food that's offered is there, and it's all being organised into these, what they call entire galamang. It's like a big tub, big metal tub like that. And so all the kind of the bags of curry and rice and all of these kinds of things are going to be sorted out at tremendous speed, and then these monks are picking up these galamangs and sprinting from one place to the other, you know, collecting all the food and bringing it round and organising everything. There was more than 100 lay women who stay in the monastery in their own section, so all that food is then organised, and all the monks are sort of organising all the food for the abhasikas and so on, and then it's all put there. It was ding. And then time for the meal, and you eat, and Ajahn Mahabur always finishes his meal in about 8 minutes or something like that, right? So remember, you're eating one meal a day, right? And you just sort of sit there and have a few bites, and yeah, he's more than 80, and he finishes his meal very fast. And of course all the young monks, you know, got a gig. Can't let the Ajahn finish quicker, right? So so they finish in like 7 minutes, except for most of them, of course, they have a lot bigger appetites, you know, to fit quite a lot of food in 7 minutes. All except for Longpo Paniwara, the English monk, and he'd just take his time, he'd be there for half an hour or something eating his food, everyone would be finishing up and packing up around him, and he'd just ignore them, keep eating at his own pace. And so everything's this whole rigmarole, everything's happening, and then it's over in almost no time. All the monks getting up and running back and doing their washing their bowls and things like that. And then as soon as the whole thing is finished, then the monks sort of kick back, light up a fag. Yeah, it kind of relaxes. I need to relax after all of that. It's in the whole kind of special culture there, and then during that time, then the, you know, the sala would fill up with the lay people coming to visit, a few hundred, and Ajahn Mahabur would talk to them for a while after the meal. And so we went to go and see him and pay respects, and of course, but you know, there's only kind of a window that we can get in there, and you know, there's a couple of hundred people there, and then we sort of going in there feeling very self-conscious and so on. Ajahn Mahabur says, talking to the microphone, and says, "Ah, oh, here come the Western monks again." Everyone laughs. So what he got, Ajahn Chandigarh organised a very nice picture of Ajahn Mun to give as a gift to Ajahn Mahabur, and he said, "Oh, we'd like to offer this." He says, "All right, I got one of them. I don't want it." And then he didn't take it. And then he said the only word in English, I think, which he knows, which was go. Go, go, go. All right, all right. Everyone's laughing. So that was that. And I guess after that we had a nice talk with Longpo Paniwara, who was very kind, gave us a good Dhamma talk. So that was one of my experiences with Ajahn Mahabur. Second experience was several years later, when he had actually started to do his Dhamma missionary work in Thailand. Now, what happened was that in 1997, I believe, or 1998, there was a big economic crisis in Thailand. You might remember many of the Asian countries, especially Thailand, had a very bad economic crash. I think it was 1998. And while everyone else was kind of doom and gloom, Ajahn Mahabur decided to use his energy to try to help the economy and try to help the Thai people, who he felt were suffering unnecessarily at that time. So this is quite an extraordinary development, because he's changing from being this very austere forest monk and very secluded and so on, to basically being on this kind of nationwide rolling Dhamma tour, collecting money, which he did for years. Now, when he was was starting that period around, I think it was about 97, I was at Bodhinyana. I just arrived at Bodhinyana, and we received a tape of this talk by Ajahn Mahabur, and I remember the monks listening to it there, and it was one of the most astonishing Dhamma talks I ever heard. Ajahn Mahabur was talking to a large group of people, And he started to, he just told his life story, told about his where he'd started and his life in Bangkok as a monk and then training with Ajahn Mun and so on. And then began to talk about the different charity works that he'd done. And even at that time, even 97, which as I said is like before he actually started the big work that he did, he was saying he'd established, I think, 60 hospitals in Thailand, rural medical centres, and they'd done all this work for animal welfare and work for money to charities and all of these kinds of things that he'd done. And you can really see that. You go to his monastery and there's nothing there, literally. Obviously a teacher like that, people are giving him so many donations, and he literally just didn't, there's nothing went to the monastery. All of it went to supporting people who are in need. And he sort of listed all of these works that he'd done to try to help people. And, so it's very important to bear this in mind, because people talk about selfish arahants, yeah? This whole idea that all the arahants are only interested in their own welfare and these kind of silly things. Well, no, that's not what happens. So, and then he started saying, well, you might think that I've done all of this so I can make merit. You might think that I'm doing this because I want to make merit. He said, that's a load of rubbish. I'm not interested in merit. My mind's gone way beyond merit and demerit years ago. And then he started to get very, very specific. Now, I can't remember the exact details, so I have to make it up, but he actually said on, very specifically, he said it was on the night, 10 o'clock in the night on the, whatever it was, July the 20th or whatever the day was, at Wat Doi Damachedi in northeast Thailand, that's when I killed all of the defilements in my mind, and I haven't had a single defilement come in my mind in all of that time. And when he said that, there was this kind of from the audience, this kind of gasp of awe / horror / astonishment. And it was like in, it was about in the mid 60s or early 60s, something like that. And so he started talking about his attainments very openly after that. And he actually said in the Dhamma talk, he said that all of the attainments that the group of five monks realized after listening to the Anattalakkhana Sutta, and they all became arahants, he said, I've realized exactly the same dhammas as they have. And so it's quite shocking, for a monk to come out and say these things so openly. Yeah? And normally if somebody does that, then you don't sort of take them too seriously, right? You sort of think, oh, this guy's kind of blowing his own trumpet, and what is this? But you have to see, you put it in context that this was, more than 30 years after the event, that he started speaking in this way. So it's, clearly not because, it's not that he can't sort of control his speech or something like that. He clearly had a very specific purpose in mind when he started to talk in this way. So this course was very controversial. One of the reasons that he used for speaking in this way was to bolster this campaign that he was doing in Thailand, to encouraging, because of course if people thought that he was arahants, then they'd give more money for the charities and so on that he was supporting. So this is what he was doing. And he also said that he was already talking about his own death at that time. And he said in that talk, he said, when I die, I don't want any monks coming and doing chanting for me, sitting there chanting Kusala Dhamma, Akusala Dhamma. My mind's got way beyond Kusala and Akusala. That's got nothing to do with me. You just throw my body out the back and let the flies come and plant the maggots in me. That's good enough. That's good enough for me. So, of course, there's no way they'll actually do that. But so then he went on this campaign where he would tour around Thailand and people would offer money and jewellery. He collected tons, literally tons of gold millions and millions of dollars worth of donations and so on. This is quite controversial, first of all, the manner that he was doing it by speaking of his attainments, and also the whether a monk should be involved to that extent in activities that were quite political. And he did become quite political and made some pretty bad mistakes, I have to admit. He told people to vote for Thaksin for a start, which is one of the reasons why Thaksin got into power in the first place. And then later on, when it turned out how corrupt he was, which of course was pretty obvious from the beginning, then he told people not to vote for him. Next time. So, you know, but this is one of the things that, you know, you might not necessarily agree with all of these things or the way that he did went about it, but to me what I love about Adamabu's character and so on is he was just so fearless, and he would just do what he really thought was right. You know, no one would ever question his integrity in what he was doing. And he's just this kind of unique character, you know, quite an individual, completely unrepeatable figure in Thai Buddhism or in world Buddhism. So it's hard to know what his, he will leave a very mixed legacy. Obviously the forest tradition now is a very different thing than what it was when he joined it, yeah, in the 1950s or something like that, and in all that time, especially from the 60s and 70s when the royal family started patronising the forest monks, then the amount of support and wealth in the forest tradition has increased to a huge degree. And of course Ajahn Mahabhur is in the minority in terms of actually being so unattached to the wealth, and when there's so much money around, then obviously that's going to attract a lot of people who are not so interested in the Dharma and the spiritual development side of things. So it's what will happen to the forest tradition to me is very uncertain. I think that it's over. I mean, I think it sort of continues in some, as it still has a legacy, but in terms of being a vital transformative tradition, I think its time has passed. And I think as these things go, that there will be something else, yeah? Some time for something new to arise and shake things up in a different way that, you know, we can't imagine at the moment, yeah, what would happen. So with his passing, he is probably the last direct link to Ajahn Mun. I think he's probably the last direct student of Ajahn Mun. And so that kind of classical era of the forest tradition is, you know, more or less at an end, with the ending of death of Ajahn Chah, Ajahn Teh in the 90s, and now Ajahn Mahabhur, probably the last of that generation. So of course there's still plenty of good monks and good monasteries in the forest tradition, but there's certainly not the same kind of revolutionary vitality that we see from monks like Ajahn Mun and Ajahn Mahabhur. So that's just a few stories and reflections on Ajahn Mahabhur and his life. So I offer that to you for your reflection this evening.